Blog Talk Radio.
Joining us again today, we have the 178th day of the year. Is that right? No, that can't be.
No.
This is the 185th day of the year. That means there's, only 181 days left. It's the 3rd of July. So if you're in North America, you've just celebrated the peaceful, all-growing nation, youthful and audacious Canada has celebrated its 149th birthday on July 1st. And the Americans are looking at their 4th of July celebrations of their military presence. I hope that everybody comes out of the holidays with a spirit of compromise and common purpose, which people like me believe is the essence of a life well spent. We have an interesting commentary today. You can see, those of you who've had a chance to look at it, that it is a terse little statement. It explains that Masonic Effects has been holding on to this topic for a while. Even within the boundaries or constraints of good taste and support of the exploration of the questions around Freemasonry, support of the constitutions, we dare to examine issues. What's on my mind, or what's on our minds? Big pictures, rather than whether the roof tiles are falling off or not. The domestic. We'll leave the domestic for another day. This is really a thought that came to me about the way we treat history. It is at times as if we're looking through a keyhole. And the interesting part is, when we do that, think about that. We're looking through a keyhole as if history is behind this locked door. And we watch it go by, but it's not enough to examine our history and examine the periods of time that has fallen out of favor. That's not a popular pursuit in Masonry. And I suspect, if thinking back on the history that I know about, the early, about the 16th, 17th century type of events. I'm not talking about the root of masonry, but constitutional masonry, perhaps, is a better way of referring to this. Masonry is something apart from our constitutions and from our grand lodges. Grand lodges license us. They create the franchise. They license us. They allow us to move within a framework of Masonic thought, Masonic structure. Not to say that any one or constitution is the embodiment of Freemasonry, and we know this because there have been various alternative groups that have existed over time. Not, of course, distinguished in terms of the inclusion of certain groups and certain ideas. So we have a healthy kind of a framework rather than a one world vision of Freemasonry. We have alternatives. Now, that gives people like me reason to examine those alternatives and examine them in their fullness, not glibly, that, you know, the power or authority tells me I'm not supposed to think like this, so I don't. I don't think any free thinking person can follow that kind of reasoning at all, or the lack of reasoning. That's more of an authoritarian drive, isn't it? That's really an appeal to the authority of Masonry. And I don't think it's too altogether comfortable, is it, to break the bonds and the philosophy of Freemasonry down to an authority. Authority is what happens. The use of authority is what happens when leadership has been abandoned or is corrupted or is inadequate. Then you have an appeal to authority. Masonry is anything but. This is the exception. This is you and me being given ideas, being handed insights, tricks of the trade of living, the geometry of life. But more of that in a minute. Come back in time with me. Let's flirt with time together. Here's something from 1931. The music today goes back a while. But these are voices that I think are still magical today. This is called, some of you will be familiar with the tune. It's called Georgia on My Mind. This was done in 1931, and this singer is a woman named Mildred Bailey. Now, this was very, very popular. And this was, Mildred passed away. She's no longer with us. She left on the 12th of December, 1951. Shortly after Alexa Mee was born. And she was a very influential American jazz singer during the 30s. And she carried the nickname Mrs. Swing, which is kind of interesting. Check this out and see what you, if it doesn't get your toes, that happens.
Oh,
Can you possibly not like Mildred? That is just to think that we live in a time now where the voice of somebody that passed away, the voice of an angel, is with us forever, ever remembered. Why? What is looking back at us when we're looking through that keyhole into the world of Freemasonry? A great big, is it, we see someone looking back at us, but we can't really distinguish who or what that person is. And even we don't know if it's a mirror and what we're seeing is a reflection of ourself. We don't know these things. Well, I'm not going to get into, pissing match between Camus and Sartre. We're not going to do that. It's not about, the trolls and the beauties of the world. This is about more a matter of the examination of our history and what it tells us. Just that fact. It's sort of like, I think the academic term is historology, the study of the, examining history as a phenomenon within itself. But always the beginnings. And for Masons like me, it's helpful to build our idea, to follow the logic. And that allows us to, when we're examining logic, of course, that we're looking at things from a philosophical point of view. All of the philosophy, I think it's been said, that it's captured in the word seriousness. If you're the kind of person from time to time, I don't mean 24/7. I think those people are preoccupied, and that's quite reasonable for some. But if they're doing that without creating any inconvenience for another person, if they can grasp the seriousness of life around, they may be more contemplative or less than you or me. But in their own right, they're not creating any inconvenience for another person. They've picked up that, embrace that Confucianism, then I think that is a Freemason. Because the fundraisers, there's many among us, can't be distinguished from, they blur the line between us and service clubs. And I don't maybe have a little bit of difficulty with that line in a contemporary setting. My struggle is two-sided. On one hand, those types of events make us feel very positive, and it's to make a contribution. And I think that's vital that we work collectively. Maybe it's because in my older age, I just find that the clamor and competition is something between men is something that I find a bit boyish. I think we would reach a point of understanding ourselves where we no longer, that we're aware of our competitiveness, our need to defeat or be the best. It is really a reflection of a meagerness of self-analysis. It's like, really, you have to keep doing that. How long is enough? And you never, is your ego never, you know, satiated? You never reached, have you not driven 1 kilometer an hour faster? Have you not climbed 1 meter higher? Have you not read 1 more book? Have you not listened to the entire collection of Louis Armstrong and Duke Ellington? It's like, you know, there comes a time when it's just, I think, the fulfillment of a stabilization where the man has control of emotion sufficient that he can penetrate the emotional thought, that reaction, the agora, reacting to something that's gone on in the population, penetrating through to witness, bear witness to the perhaps a greater truth, what's really going on, what's the evidence, what's the fact, what's happening, without being swayed by the emotion of other people. That, to me, is masonry. That's a Freemason that can do that. But the start of history, hard to say where we're going to put that. So I go back as far as I can in history to try and track this puppy. And I'm looking at Herodotus. So I want to talk to you a little bit today, if it's all right with you, about the start of this. And particularly, I'll be a bit chauvinistic about it. It does have to do with Pythagoras, which I find enormously interesting because I just don't quite understand the man and the thought. Although the one-liners that come out of the Pythagorean school are pretty interesting. Enjoying the heroic past with Homeric bards. If this line alone, why would anyone turn to the prosaic past that came to be known as history? This alone suggests to us that we need to get a faded copy of Homer's work, The Odyssey, and read it. Read it as much for the fact as for the storyline. And then read it for the experience. What reaction do you have once your mind is unlocked? That's masonry. Unlock that mind. Freemasonry is not compliance in a uniform telling us what to do and how to think. It is not. If you've been exposed to the teachings of ritual as if it's regimented, somebody has missed a valuable chapter in that analysis. Ritual is what we do in common to take us to a point, to help us to achieve. Think of ritual as the mantra. Now, you would have your own, absolutely. So within the ritual, within that framework, is you looking through that keyhole and setting yourself the challenge of understanding what the ritual does. What is the point of it? Oh my goodness, that means we get over that boyish sense of that childishness of whether we like it or don't like it. I don't like this because I don't understand it. That's too childish for me. So if that's you turn the program off if you're. I'm being facetious here, of course. Freemasonry allows those of us who go beyond that to begin an understanding, an in-depth understanding. It's not like looking at a piece of porcelain and deciding whether we like it or not. Although, yeah, you know, that's important in a sense. But it's to understand what that porcelain, understand the porcelain, the design, the composition, the craftsmanship, the epoch. What does it tell us about the period that it was produced? Similarly with ideas, that's what we're doing here. We're examining these ideas at arm's length, and perhaps not so far away, to consider also what it tells us prima facie, what the content of these ideas tell us, but also what these ideas tell us about the times and the thinking. And if you do that, you notice that thinking has changed. Thinking changes continuously. That's an evolution. New information changes our ideas. And if you're thinking back to whether we like this or not, really, in the universe out there, what does whether you or I like something have to do with the forces and powers around us? Really, when we're children, we're naive. It's a rare one of us as a child that it comprehends and reasons. It's a rare child. But we begin to do that at an age where we don't necessarily have the language to articulate those ideas. As adults, we do. But so often we're governed by our anxieties. If we particularly, as you know, where there's darkness, where there's ignorance, where we don't understand something, too often it prompts a legitimization of fear, of anxieties. We have a right and an obligation to be afraid because of things we do not understand. Wow. The mighty human mind, that's what we're brought down to. That's what we were. That's what our the ancients governed. That's superstition. I don't understand it, therefore it's powerful, and I need to be governed by fear. Despots do that. Are you afraid of criticism? Really? Are you afraid? Have you reached a point where some of your ideas are your ideas and not derivatives of something that are not what somebody else has told you to think? Stepping beyond what other people tell you to think is Freemasonry. Oh, does it mean we can be erudite? Does it mean we can be aggressive? Come. That isn't Freemasonry. That's being a lout, being coarse, being vulgar. Masonry, doesn't it teach you to greet, to identify yourself? Don't think about the country lodges where people can't make eye contact with you if you're a stranger. Don't do that. And don't think of those lodges where if you bring it up, fingers are pointed at you. But you know the bad manners when you see them. And that has nothing to do with Freemasonry. That has to do with the particular type of men that are in that lodge. Lodge is where we share ideas, tips, hang with each other, got your back, intellectually. We're there in the pursuit of something. But in a way, it's like being in a congregation where you look around and you know that people are sort of that sheepishness, that sheep group. They may likely have no idea about the uniqueness of the faith that they're following compared to other faiths out there. It's the fact that they just do it because it's what their parents did. There's a lot of that. There's a lot of that in this country. And oh my goodness, does it lead to complications? Oh my goodness, yes, of course. But when you, if you were to challenge this group of people, this idea alone is challenges. Do you understand what it is your faith is based on? If the person doesn't have a need for that, if they feel that asking those questions, although the greatest theological minds in the world would suggest to us that questioning it allows us to reason through and to find and discover answers. But that's not compelling, is it? Nobody compels you. Similarly with Freemasonry, there's no compelling force other than the fact that it's at every step presented to us. It's presented to us as the need to understand, to replace ignorance and superstition with reason. And metaphorically, we refer to that as the light, star in the east. Wonderful metaphors with lots and lots of science to support them. But more importantly, for the likes of me and you, it conveys a beautiful story, a myth that is easy to remember. And we want to remember because it's compelling. The appearance of historiography, the writing of history in classical Greece, was one of their most remarkable and surprising achievements. For the cast of Greek thought in the age of Socrates and Plato was conspicuously anti-historical. According to Plato, the only subject of genuine knowledge was what was permanent and unchanging. So the ancient Greeks had the greatest respect for mathematical knowledge. Bet you didn't know that. And Pythagoras elevated numbers into the key to the universe, the geometry that helped us understand our relativity in the universe. They dwelt on the distinction between true knowledge, or what they referred to as episteme, think of epistemologists, yeah, and the mere opinion, or what they called doxa, knowledge and opinion. Then, why pursue the uncertain accounts of changing human actions, of societies born and decayed? What difference does it make? At the same time, as we have seen in the face-to-face community of the polis, the idealization of the evanescence spoken over the enduring written word, expressed in the way of dialogue, removed some temptations to make written records of their thoughts. Poetry is something more philosophic and of graver import than history, observed Aristotle, since its statements are of the nature of universals, whereas those of history are singulars. Poetry, he's saying, reveals ideas that are universal. It means that they speak to all of us, that they are values, observations that have relevance to all of us. The birth of history in ancient Greece was the legacy of two originals, Herodotus and Thucydides. Both were exiles, and so the readier, the readier to pursue a kind of knowledge not valued in their home polis. They had to step away from home in order to have step away from the constraints the provincial thought thinking. Unlike the anonymous myth makers, they signed their names at the onset of their work, and their twin legacy would suggest the questions of historians for millennia to come. What had really happened, and why? What were the lessons of the past for the future? The word history in Greek, of Ionian origin, meant inquiry. It had first connoted research into the nature of the physical world. Miletus, on the Ionian coast of the eastern Mediterranean, had been the home of Thales. He was born in 1624 BC, founder of the first Greek school of philosophy. From there, too, Hecateus appears to have been the first to apply this method of investigation from nature to the inhabited earth. He traveled widely and was one of the first logographers, recording traditions and genealogies of mythical families. They were mostly interested in the legendary foundations of cities and in the variety of local customs. Hecateus' statement of purpose is a rudimentary credo of the historian. What I write here is the account of what I consider to be true. For the stories of the Greeks are numerous and, in my opinion, ridiculous. His genealogies tended to make the mythical past more credible. These logographers expressed the characteristic Greek interest, not surprisingly for our seafaring people, in the dominating power of the physical environment. His interests were more in geography, the variety of present phenomena on the earth, than in the shaping power of past events. The works of logographers survive only in fragments, and they left nothing that could be called a work of history. But the first such work did somehow grow out of their tradition, and when it appeared, it opened paths into the past. The exuberant Ionian intellectual adventure was not to be frustrated by a mere dogma of philosophy, such as the French Enlightenment of the 18th century would dissolve Christian orthodoxies, defrock clergy, and guillotine kings. So the Ionian Enlightenment of the 6th century BC shook revered icons of Greek culture as it opened endless paths of inquiry. Thales had asked general questions about nature and sought rational answers. As Bertrand Russell observed, Thales set philosophers on their paths to understand the world, called physicists from the Greek physis, for nature. They tried to find the single substance, air or water, from which the world was made. When the Ionians turned their inquiry on man himself, they took another look at their past, asking whether their myths were an adequate account. And what Socrates, at the cost of his life, did for Greek philosophy awakened fellow Athenians to the discovery of their ignorance. The one thing he did know was that he didn't know much. Herodotus did for their quest for the past. This Ionian Enlightenment questioned the mythic view embodied in the Homeric epics and Hesiod. Homer and Hesiod have attributed to the gods Xenophanes, the wandering Ionian poet from Colophon, observed everything that is disgraceful and blameworthy among men, theft, adultery, and deceit. So they demythifies the past in search of qualities of man, and their past would not remain a vacuum. It would be filled soon by something quite new, of which Herodotus was to be the creator and the patron saint. Myth, from the Greek for word, was a name for the comforting authentic tales of origins. As we have seen, the Homeric bard sang a reassuring tradition of the virtues and exploits of heroes. Their tales did not shock or surprise, but solace by the familiar themes of Achilles or of Odysseus or Agamemnon or Menelaus. The poetic epithets and embellishments, too, were in recognized formulas. But history was quite another world. The word history in Ionian Greek meant inquiry or investigation, focused on the seeking rather than on the finding. We have seen how myth, authenticated by generations of chanting bards, responded to the expectations of living audiences. So the bards' tales were being modified, not by newly discovered shapes of the past, but by the novel expectations of each living, listening generation. History, from this beginning, would also become the name for a never-ending effort. Recollection. Recollection of the past was an endless reaching. The past would no longer be a brilliant panoply of familiar verse, but a dark continent of memory. Perhaps it could be newly illuminated in every generation. While myth was an anonymous product of community, history would be the work of the inquiring individual. We may speak of Homeric epics, though they may never have been a Homer, but history begins with historians. Herodotus, by consensus of scholars, is our first historian, the father of what we think of as history. And unlike the anonymous Homer, from his first words, Herodotus leaves no doubt as to his authorship or the nature of his enterprise. These are the researches of Herodotus, or Halicarnassus, which he publishes in the hope of thereby preserving from decay the remembrance of what men have done, and of preventing the great and wondrous actions of the Greeks and the barbarians from losing their due meed of glory, and withal to put on record what were their grounds of feud. So with his word researches, Herodotus announced one of the greatest shifts in human consciousness, not often enough recognized. Here was the shift from mere recording and repetition of tradition to the scrutiny of experience. And so the historian opened the gateway to the infinite past, a new eternity. Before Herodotus, besides the Homeric epics in the oral tradition of the bards, there had been logographers. But they were not investigators asking whether or why. So the father of history, the title given to Herodotus by Cicero, has been confirmed by centuries of scholarships. Before Herodotus, describers of the past not inquiring were simply recording or reporting. They were not writing history, but in R.J. Collingwood's phrase, writing religion. They were recording known facts for the information of persons to whom they were not known, but whom, as worshippers of the god in question, ought to know the deeds whereby he has made himself manifest. This new spirit of inquiry was conspicuously expressed in their language, in the shift from poetry to prose. The traditional epic themes of Homeric bards were perpetuated in verse, which was the common aid to memory for an illiterate society. History, the language of inquiry, would be written in prose. And Herodotus' history is the first masterpiece in Greek prose. The writing of history, a new branch of literature, as the Roman rhetorician Quintilian observed, brought Greek prose to a new height. Some admirers of Herodotus have credited him as the creator of scientific history. But this emphasis overlooks the uniqueness of the historian's task. The ancient Greeks were pioneers in many fields of science, other realms of inquiry. But history was a literary art, because in history the subject and its audience were one. The effective historian is always telling us about ourselves, revealed in our human past. He cannot be a great historian unless he actually speaks to us. If he is a great historian, he never becomes obsolete, though he can be supplemented. With pleasure, we still read Herodotus and Thucydides. It is no accident that the father of history was in the vanguard of ancient Greek literature, so our greatest historians, like Gibbon, hold as high a rank in literature as in history. Regardless of his place in the history of history, critics place Herodotus nearer to Shakespeare than to Thucydides, and next to Homer. For Wordsworth, Herodotus' history was the most interesting and instructive book, next to the Bible, which had ever been written. How did it happen that our gateway to the infinite past was opened by this Herodotus of Halicarnassus? We know very little of his life beyond what he reveals in his history. We'll come back. We'll talk about his family another day. It's off the west coast of Asia Minor. History, for Freemasons, is that, I think, what we're hearing here is about inquiry. The investigation. So, can I presume that the audience of Masonic Effects have that characteristic in common? To make investigation an inquiry. And to answer the questions, whether and why. Why did these things happen the way they did? Here, a little taste, another drop of history for you all. For all of us from 1930, this is Marlene Dietrich, the siren of all sirens, falling in love again. The woman that brought the warring armies common thought. This is from the movie Blue Angel in 1930.
Professor,
what is it?
1930. Man. Beautiful voice. But I digress again. Let's think about the pertinence and relevance of what we've been talking about in Masonic context. After all, it is what we are. Here. It's hard to understand in itself because there's so much. If we start the idea, follow the idea of investigation, our history is enriched. We discover that the ritual was composed at different points in time. We have our scholars looking at the nature of the findings. What does history tell us about the ideas that were brought together? Some of them, like the second degree, seems to be like a cut and paste. It doesn't have the same flow as the first and third. Now, historians, I find it quite an interesting phenomenon that we have this sense of orthodoxy within Freemasonry, that if it's not being printed within the world of Freemasonry, then it's not legitimate. I don't know that we would have Pythagoras included in it, in this, because none of that work or the history, Homer's work, were printed by the Masonic press, the so-called Masonic press. I think that the Masonic press and the legitimization of it came about because of the marketplace, not because of the ideas. It became convenient, and I still go, you and I still turn to certain sources that tend to, by their very nature, to validate and authenticate the work that they're printing. In a way that the popular press may not. So it's not to say that all of those, if we're accepting that everything that's printed by these shops is valid, then we're really cutting off our own investigation. Those things, in the last 10 years, I can say, I can attest, a lot of what we've experienced is been an upgrade of fact that's rewritten the history. Some of the earlier materials that I was handed as the authenticated history of Freemasonry have been eclipsed by new findings. Our archaeologists, our investigation is unending. And I think this is going to be the way forever, because this is a meal that is so appealing. There's so much intrigue, there's so much observation, there's so much about the nature of the times when things were written, that it helps us to pull together history in a very, very phenomenal kind of focus. For me, it was a phenomenal kind of focus. I think it's remarkable and not common for me to look at the world through a particular lens and to find a relevance. Now, if you mention 1717 to the likes of us, it brings us to an interesting point in British history, in European history. It's like a watershed moment, and it is in a large way. It's not. It's like we're shifting, bringing into a focus this lens into back in time to 1717. And then we begin to look at the history, prehistory of those events. We begin to investigate the thinking of the people that put their signature to the earliest formation of Grand Lodge structure. This was a remarkably foresighted idea. We know that not then, we know that in hindsight. At the time, it was still speculative. There was that question that of relevance. Why do we need this? Truly, why do we need this now? We've never had it before. We've done quite well. So there was the idea that this collective, this, you know, community would somehow bring about gains and advantages of common purpose that would not be possible if we were to remain as a collective of individuals, collective of lodges, collective of different forms of the myths and ritual of Freemasonry. I, for one, am grateful that we have other streams of Masonry being practiced in this country, because it tells us more about what we are by examining what we are not. It's an interesting aspect of having the different rituals growing around us that tells us that we were not we did not come about as a result of a singularity and with a fracture. There was growth of Masonic, the philosophy of Freemasonry, common purpose, the connection with our geometry. You see Herodotus thinking about what was something that was permanent. Well, math was and is permanent. So not something transient and due to opinion, but something with permanence behind it. And I wear a symbol of the Pythagorean, one of the first proofs. And you can imagine at the time now, we will say to that at the time, the proof of that geometry was magical. That was magic in the day. It wasn't like fakery. It was something that was otherworldly about it. I'm going to put on a little bit of Ruth Etting, just because it's from 1927. And then we're going to tuck into a context of Freemasonry that draws on history. Here. Listen to Ruth.
Lovers depend on moonlight for a love affair. Babies depend on mothers for their tender care. Flowers depend on sunshine and the morning dew. These things depend I can be lonely out in a crowd. I can be humble, I can be proud. It all depends on you. I can save money or spend it, go right on living, or end it. You're to blame, honey, for what I do. I know that I can be beggar, I can be king, I can be almost any old thing. It all depends on you.
That was recorded on the 28th of February, 1927. Oh, what a charming voice. Ruth, come sit down. Have some coffee with us. Later, I'll put on Dancing in the Moonlight by Ruth. That's from 1933. Put it up and up and up. Oh, I promised you that we'd talk a little bit more about the history and the Masonic context, and here it is, baby. Hang on to your hat. We're going to talk about that last degree. Do you want to know what the evidence in history tells us? Now, is this history that is only known to a select group of males in the world? Or is history just out there? Is history just out there to be discovered by investigators? Or do we discover this little pearl and try to keep it to ourselves? I think we're naive to think that history belongs to any one person or any one group. I think that's truly, mistaken. And here's the reasons why. You think about history as the Greeks portrayed it, as Cicero ascribed this to Herodotus, what, 6th century, 7th century BC? Okay. It's inquiry. Does anybody own the inquiry? Does anybody have a right to even claim? Well, we do if we're full of, we're oozing superstition. Evidence suggests that the third degree in its distinctly Aramic form had a late development in the form of the ceremony originating in the 1720s. That got my attention. You get yours? The first minute of the working of the third degree comes not from a lodge, but from the minute book of the Apollonian Society for the Lover of Music and Architecture. Ha! Only it's our own conceit that tries to reform or revise history to make these types of things within the fabric of masonry. These types of things were outside of it, just like we've always existed on that wavelength of intellectual pursuit, the curiosity of science. All of the members of that society were Masons, Freemasons. Interestingly, architecture and music were seen and heard as kindred arts. On the 12th of May, 1725, Brother Charles Cotton and Brother Pepion Ball were regularly passed masters. Cotton had already been initiated and passed to the second degree in a regular lodge at the Queen's Head Tavern, Hollis, in the Strand. The Duke of Richmond was master at that lodge, as well as being Grand Master of the Premier Grand Lodge of England. According to John Hamill, The Craft, that was written in 1986, that's Hamill with two L's, the proceedings of the Philomusica were, of course, completely irregular and were strongly reprimanded by the Grand Secretary. From 1726, references began to appear to show lodges working all three degrees. Now, what we're led to believe here in our investigation is that the third degree was developed, the first mention of it was developed in an irregular setting. The Philomusica, a Architectura Societas Apolloni, or the Apollonian Society for the Lover of Music and Architecture. On the 5th of March, 1737, at Kew, Kew Garden, an occasional lodge was held at the palace of Frederick Lewis, Prince of Wales, eldest son and heir to George II, and presided over by Dr. de Soto. Ever keen for royal patronage and greater Masonic authority and influence was de Soto. Help me, my Francophone friends. The Prince of Wales was made entered apprentice in fellowcraft on the same evening. The lodge was reconvened at a later date to pass the Prince of Wales as a master mason. In 1738, the prince became master of a lodge with 3 degrees established as customary, though the third was often reserved for lodge masters within the Premier Grand Lodge of England until the end of the century. And with the blessings of the royal house and British aristocracy, Freemasonry was ready for export. The novel of Freemasonry has long passed from the 18th century to this. The fascination has seemingly passed. Hundreds of years, it's become, in some areas, it's been let to become pedestrian. We hear wonderful Masons, just very, very incredible men, worried about the passage of time and the need to take time to rediscover the essence of Masonry, to light the candle, to create the spark, to bring inspiration back into the proceedings. What's inspiring is when we see somebody else being inspired, that inspires us. That effort of supreme contribution, something of sublime beauty. I don't think anybody can manufacture that environment. And I don't think any one organization on the face of the earth can ever do itself justice, suggesting for a moment that it is going to be the purveyor of all that is inspiring. You think, how many times can you read the same book over and over? I think the challenge here is absence makes the heart grow fonder. But how do we do that? By changing perspective, by changing the time frame. To be able to count on our artists to define history in a beautiful way, in an interesting, scintillating way. Right now in this country, our history is being rewritten from the droll, the embarrassment that it has been. It was allowed to be written as if only military men created history and did anything of significance. Nobody of color and no woman. No artist, no philosopher, only politicians, only military. As if the skin of history had been pulled away. Now we've realized that there was a richness that makes our history accessible. So too in Freemasonry, do I think this is a necessary step that is coming to us quickly. And none too soon. Now I have to go now. I don't know where the time goes. We'll get into this again about the spread of Freemasonry if you don't mind, I think that would be kind of cool. When Britain decided, this is kind of, it echoes loudly of, I can't, you know, I'm getting deaf by the echoes of imperialism here. This, okay. Polite company, it's not working well for me. I look forward to having you join us all next week. Thank you very much for your patience, your questions, your time. Commit those acts of Masonic kindness and take care of one another. This is Sheila Jordan.
Thank you.